Captain Bauer, Reel 4. We'd been talking about you going into the line and the various arrangements for living there and operating there. How long do you think it took you to settle in before you were fully fit to meet an enemy attack?
That's difficult to say, I think. Overall, clearly, after we'd been in and out of the line a few times, people were used to the idea. But to start with, I think that it was such a cultural shock, if you see what I mean. Although we'd had plenty of training and everything, but actually, in the long run, the Geordies were very adaptable people. I think this is what I'm trying to say, that they were very adaptable people. And I think that one would be surprised at how quickly they did adapt to the circumstances. I think, that, of course, that the real thing was, although we'd had endless training, we hadn't had real live casualties or real live bullets and mortar bombs and shells and so on. And so you weren't actually, although you were pretty conditioned, we hadn't up until that time had to tend to wounded comrades and look after the dead and deal with the actual real live risk. But apart from that, I think probably the nature of the Geordie and the Pitman was the digging, and we were living with Mother Earth anyway. And I think that we adapted pretty quickly, on the whole, surprisingly. But that was a lot, I think, to do with the training that we'd had. And one other aspect, which I'd forgotten to mention last time, was that we did, on top of having Camp Britannia, we had a period in the mock line, in other words. Although we were a long way behind, and we weren't being shelled, we were living in exactly the same way that we were going to live in 2 or 3 weeks hence. So there'd been an awful lot of conditioning, but I think that actually adaptation to the line was pretty quick.
How long were you in the mock line?
It was about 2 weeks, I think.
And was it identical to the front line?
Well, yeah, again, you see, contradiction in terms, because we weren't being shot at. We didn't have to keep our heads down. We didn't have to pick up bodies and that kind of thing and deal with wounded, and we weren't in the danger area. And that, of course, is a terrific difference. It's rather like doing a night exercise with no real ammunition, if you see what I mean. But it was a second stage. I mean, we had Yorkshire, we had Camp Britannia, we had the mock line idea. It was a very good idea because you had to dig, and there were positions already there. And I think they were probably used previously in the war, you know, when the thing was fluid. And so it gave people an idea. Their rations were sent up, you were on your own, that kind of thing. And so you ran your own show, as you were going to do in a few weeks' time. So it was a preamble.
Was there anyone playing the part of enemy when you were in the mock line?
No, not really. This was purely conditioning, I think, you know, to get you used to living in a hole, digging your hutchie, sleeping in the trench and the stuff, you know, and having rations brought up and cooking for yourself and all that kind of thing, and dealing with sanitation and stuff which one hadn't previously done, you know, in a camp situation.
So it's a matter of getting used to the domestic administration.
Yes, very nicely put. I just said that was it, really, sort of that kind of thing.
When you were in the line and out of the line, how long would you spend in the line before having a rest?
It was 2 to 3 weeks was the average. I don't think we spent longer than that in the line. Not that I can recall. And 2 to 3 weeks, of course, was quite long enough.
Then how long out of it?
2 to 3 weeks. It was the article which I'd like you to see. But I think that Colonel Peter Jeffries says, I think out of the, we were 6 months, although we were 30 months in Korea, we were 6 months in the line. And that's how it worked. And we had a period of, during the middle of our year, we had, the division was pulled out. So we had something like 6 weeks in reserve. And funnily enough, looking back on it, people didn't like it very much. You know, it was very unsettling in a kind of way. People went on leave, went to Tokyo and all this kind of thing. And it was you know, like going back to school, any worse. And it was probably been better, in fact, to have kept the momentum up 2 weeks in, 2 weeks out, or 3 weeks in, 3 weeks out. But, I mean, that was the way of things. The whole division was pulled out, and we had 6 weeks or 8 weeks in camp, that kind of thing. And I remember it was very cold as well. But generally speaking, in answer to your question, it was 2 to 3 weeks.
Did you find it unsettling to go back into the line after 2 weeks in reserve?
Not really, not really. I think you got used to it. You know, we did a lot of training in reserve anyway. The only difference was that, you know, conditions were fairly tough anyway. You had probably more warmth, I think, than you would have done in the line. We had these terrible oil-burning stoves, which were very smelly and terribly dangerous. But I think, generally speaking, the men were happier in the line because, you know, that's what they'd gone to Korea for, and they were living in cells, as it were, you know, with their mates. And of course, you came out into reserve, you had to conform your inspections and kind of stuff and exercises which weren't all that popular, you know. And things reverted to normal. You had an officer's mess. You know, it was a sort of jolt to the system, as it were, which had to be. It's quite right. But I think that, generally speaking, people were probably happier in the line than they were out of the line. That's purely my own view.
How far behind the line would you be when you were in one of these reserves?
Well, this was a surprising thing. Never very far. It could be a mile or a mile and a half. Because of no threat from the air. Once you were, which I think I previously said, once you were out of the line by, say, a few hundred yards, you know, you were in comparative safety. Like, battalion headquarters was a pretty safe area. It was very seldom that battalion headquarters caught a shell, or might have caught a shell, not a mortar bomb. But one was probably a mile, 2 miles. It depended where you were going from, you know, what area you'd been allocated. But it was never very far.
Do you think being in reserve would have been more unsettling if you'd been further away from the front line?
No, I don't think it would have made any difference. Because one was safe, probably, I'm underestimating it by saying a mile, but even so, there wasn't much in it. You know, we all got into trucks and we were taken out. And, you know, rather sense of relief for a day or two until you were smartened up a bit. But it wasn't far.
When did you first receive the hostile attentions of the enemy?
Oh, more or less straight away. I remember very well my first position, and I think that it was proven later that we were very much more visible than we thought. We took over from the Australians, and my position was called Jan's Land. I'm not quite sure what the significance is. I know that later on we talked about Alice Springs, and that I understand. But we were very much more visible than we thought, and we were walking in areas where we were more obvious to the enemy than I think we thought we were. And we attracted a lot of attention in the form of mortaring. And so within the first day or two, we were started to be mortared. And that was the most aggressive thing that the Chinaman could do to us. There was always, obviously, the threat of attack, and one whole raison d'etre was part of either patrolling or defending. And so, you know, in the defensive position, you had to be certain number of your platoon company was standing too. We can get onto that probably later. But the otherwise, you were on the end of their mortaring, most of which were American mortars. All the ammunition that they'd captured when the Americans drew back. But, yes, in answer to your question again, quite soon.
Was their mortaring accurate?
That's a very good question, because it was very strange. It wasn't really accurate. I think if they saw some movement, they'd drop a few in, you know. If they were, you know, there were a lot of obviously very accurate shots, but I don't think they were aiming at accuracy. And after all, no one's yet produced a really accurate mortar. You know, you can lay down, can't you, a square of stuff. And it was never sort of, now and again, I remember very well, I think one of the forward companies was hit, and we thought there was almost certainly going to be an attack. But it was would have been a daylight attack. But for some unknown reason, it got absolutely hit for, you know, half an hour or more. And you just felt for your mates because it wasn't far away, you know, rather like, I suppose, if we were in the left or right of the hook or something like that. And one felt sure they were going to be attacked, and so everyone was absolutely stood too. But generally speaking, it was just a few mortar bombs would come down, probably when you were digging or something. And they had their desired effect was that you kept your heads down, and of course, a lot of people got wounded that way.
Did you suffer any losses in your platoon through mortar attack?
In overall, yes, overall. My first experience was we had a section of machine guns the medium machine guns, and one of the chaps was very badly hit. But I didn't have any casualties for quite a long time, which was, you know, it's sort of God pointing the finger, you know, it was... Not so much. I suppose you could say it was good fortune, but someone else was getting it, you know. But you say overall, our casualties were light compared to a lot of regiments that had been in Korea before us. And you look at our casualties now, and people would say, well, you know, it was nothing really. But it was a great deal at the time. As I think I told her, I think I could confirm this, but it was, you know, 12 people killed or something, and 3 people missing, and 168 wounded, that kind of figure. We can check that later. But, you know, it wasn't altogether a huge number of... But, you know, it was very important. But we didn't have many in my platoon to start with. But overall, I think I can't remember now, but I think at the end of the war, I may have lost about 4 people killed and several wounded, that kind of thing.
And these were lucky shots, were they?
Lucky shots, yes. A lot of it was attracted... You know, with unconsciously, you know, you could make a, you might have been spotted and that kind of thing, or they might have from Narayan just lobbed in a few bombs, you know, and caught you.
What was the response when they did mortar? Did you call up artillery?
Yes, you always had. You see, you always had your standing patrol. You had people watching. Well. I'll think of it.
Observers.
It was always, every day and night. During the day, you had a number of people. Company strength. In a company area, you'd have quite a lot of people permanently watching. Because during the day, most people would be asleep anyway. That would be the general idea in the companies, the platoons. You always had people awake and watching. And that was one of the reasons for the standing patrols at night and this kind of thing. And so if you saw a puff of smoke and you had your artillery observer with you as well, always a strong Royal Artillery presence. And so if you saw anything, it got hit very quickly. And I think that this was probably one of the reasons why they were... fairly conservative about their mortaring, because they knew very well that they were going to absolutely socked, you know, and the artillery could bring down a division in, you know, straight away if you wanted it. And the retaliation was pretty good.
Did you find it easy to spot their mortar positions?
No, not at all. It was very difficult. It was very difficult to spot anything, actually. But when you did spot something, then you really got to grips with it. And you can imagine the boys sitting there, 2 or 3 chaps sitting there with a radio and their line, they'd have the line telephone as well, hoping for something to happen. You know, so if there was any movement, they'd be onto it straight away.
What about the Chinese artillery? How did you find that?
This was another anomaly about the Korean War, because... Where you were close, they didn't use artillery. Where you were far away, which then they did. We had a position at the end of the war where I think it must have been something like 2 miles or a mile or something between us. That's an exaggeration, but it was, compared to what it had been, it seemed a hell of a long distance. And then they used their artillery. But they could have done, they could have, when we arrived in Korea, the first good news was that the Chinese artillery was becoming more active. But they could have caused so much more trouble if they'd wanted to. It's the most extraordinary thing. They had no air, and their artillery was very, very sparsely used, because they could have hit battalion headquarters, they could have gone further back, you know, easily. With big guns, you could have hit division headquarters, I should think, or brigade headquarters easily. But for some unknown reason, they didn't.
You weren't ever subjected to a mass infantry attack, were you?
No, we weren't. As a battalion, we weren't. I think it was probably a very good thing, but I don't know that it was a good thing at all. I mean, how can you weigh this thing after the event? But no, we weren't. We planned, it's probably changing the subject very slightly, but there were one or two attacks planned. In my time, there were three. I think we did two, I remembered, and I was personally not actually actively involved, except from supporting. We did a platoon attack, a section attack. No, it wasn't. It was a platoon attack in my time, and I wasn't in that. There was one, and we were going to do a... There were nothing bigger than a... No, this was a platoon attack. There were it was a company attack once, I think, which was not particularly successful, and another one which was aborted because it was attracting too much attention. But we were never actually subjected to, like the Gloucesters and people like that, you know, a full. It was amazing that we weren't really, but we weren't, and it could be toward the fact that it was towards the end of the war, but. No one really knew that, except that, you know, the indications were that the war was going to end at some time.
But if you had been, then that's when your Brownings would really have come into their own.
Well, here again, you see, in my view now, 30 years gone, that the Brownings weren't in the right position. But if they'd attacked where we'd been, I think any position, we were extremely well defended. Most of the positions, all the positions that we took over from other people, we immediately, like beavers, you know, started repairing the wires, checking the minefields, making sure that our fighting pits were in good condition. And I think that, you know, if the Chinaman had attacked us, it would have been quite a revelation to see exactly how we would have managed. But we never got that opportunity. But we didn't actually...
As a matter of identification, how did you know that the enemy facing you were Chinese rather than North Korean?
You didn't. You didn't. You had no idea. One assumed they were Chinamen. You know, there was no. I'm not sure when the North Koreans came in. Were the North Koreans mixed up with the Chinese? So one wouldn't have known. No idea. We just assumed that our natural enemy in front of us were Chinese.
What was the main offensive activity of the battalion then? Was it patrolling at night?
Patrolling was our main domination of our own territory, was the chief concept of our being there, apart from, I suppose, repelling borders at some stage. But domination of our area. We had... Let's see, how many different styles of patrols? You had a standing patrol, which could be a corporal and one, or an officer and one, or a sergeant and one, or two. That would be the main thing. This was when you actually left your position. This was nothing to do with observers during the day. You had a standing patrol. The next thing was a recce patrol, which could be an NCO and two or three men. And then a fighting patrol, I think. Well, those were basically... So a recce patrol would... a standing patrol would go out and listen and watch. And we had one or two people who would go out and spend probably 36 hours So they'd be there night, day, night, and just lying up and watching, which must have been rather hairy. And that was probably one officer or one sergeant, that kind of thing. They'd go out in the dark and sit there or lie up, you know.
Would such a patrol have a line of communication?
Yes, sometimes, yeah. Difficult, though, you see, you were really sort of on your own, and you could never be sure whether you'd been seen or not. And so, I mean, any movement with a radio and that kind of thing or something, but I think, yes, there was, obviously, and if the nearer you were, clearly your standing person wasn't all that far away. That was quite a hairy thing. I never did that myself.
How close to the enemy lines would you go with such a standing patrol?
Well, that was really left to the person doing it, and often quite near. And depending on the ground and the guts of the person concerned, and how valuable. And one or two of them, you know, were able to report on movement during the day which you couldn't otherwise see. So there was that kind of in itself, I suppose you would call it a patrol. But what did I call it before?
The recce patrol.
Recce patrol. And the fighting patrol. I mean, you could meet anyone at any time. So you had standing, recce, and fighting. That was more or less it. And then the individual going by himself was a one-off, you know, a special. It was never a good thing, in my view, to send too many people out at once. I personally I experienced a disaster because of too many people. And later on, there was a company sweep, they used to call them sweep patrol. And the problem there was that it was communication and losing your way. And then if you ran into trouble, if there were a lot of you, you know, keeping control was extremely difficult. And I think that it was found in the fullness of time that it was never a good idea to send too many people out in a bunch, because you'd find, in my view, that people would be too concerned about themselves and not about what was happening. Do you see what I mean? You know, if you've got a 5 patrol or a 10-man patrol, at maximum, one officer, sergeant, and then you can watch and hope and keep a certain amount of control. But if you lose your way and you stumble into minefields which you didn't know were there, or your officer was killed, or you were then picked up casualties, you know, what a mess. And that happened once or twice, and it was due mainly, or because of, too many people going out together.
Thinking about it, if you're going out on a patrol at night, given limitations on your range of vision and passing of orders and information, how many people can you actually control if you're in command of a patrol group?
You see, the training was such that you rather hoped that you could rely, and I think that the men realised this in the fullness of time, because you couldn't see. You may not even remember where one chap on your right and one chap on your left was, because of the ground, the paddy fields, the ditches, the water, and so on. You relied on sound, which was difficult because you didn't want to start whistling too much. Whistling was very much the thing. Geordie songs, you know, Bladen Races, First Bar or something. That sort of thing. You simply had to rely on the initiative of your chaps, and that was about it, really. Hopefully, because you know everybody was a shit scarce, everybody else, and you, as a commander of you know, your main concern was keeping control, not losing your way, and so you were so concerned with so many things, you didn't have time to be frightened, really. But I think everybody deep down was pretty scared. It was a very unpleasant pleasant situation, because, you know, you were in that situation where you could quite easily lose your way. Then you had to get back. That was always my worry. My prime worry, as soon as I left my particular minefield gap, was, Christ, you know, let's hope I can find my way back. When the moon was bright, it was marvellous, but of course then you were that much more vulnerable, because you had some amazing full moons. Unbelievable. It was like daylight. And sometimes it was almost too dangerous. But then when it was dark, that was the real problem, you know, finding your way back. Because the rule was, you guard from, say, for instance, A company, one of their gaps, and you'd come back in C company, in one of their gaps.
You'd do a loop in between, would you?
Yeah, and you can imagine what that was like.
Were the gaps into the minefield marked in any way?
Not really, not very well. But they were, clearly, obviously, not clearly, it's not the word I'm looking for, but there were, the discipline of the minefield marking, as far as I was concerned, was always an anomaly. But even so, you know, you put wire around and you put minefield tags up so that you knew the minefield was there, and the enemy knew that the minefield was there. But even so, it was, despite the fact that you knew it was there, it was still a deterrent.
Presumably you had a good concentration of fire down there.
Oh yes, absolutely. And you'd be, probably one of your machine guns would be laid on it, and a couple of mortars, that kind of thing. It was, but it was the problem of sometimes losing your way. I lost my way once on a patrol, and it was, you know, terribly easily done.
In that terrain, were there reasonably recognisable landmarks upon which you could take a sort of instinctive bearing?
Yes, yes, because you were in your position for two, three weeks, and you wrecked each other's. If, for instance, you were going to take a patrol out and you were going to come back into, you know, your next door companies, you would go and have a look at it during the day from their position, you know, so you'd recognise it by a tree or a blown up tomb or something like that, you know. But you have plenty of time to do that kind of thing, do your homework beforehand. But yes, clearly. Fortunately, it wasn't like the desert or something like that. There were plenty of things to spot and watch out for.
What was the ground like? Was the ground and the terrain generally noisy, or was it easier to move through it with a reasonable
silence? Yes, fairly, because a lot of it was frozen water. You had paddy fields, so you had, you know, banks and then dips. It wasn't too difficult. It was pretty flat, in fact, in between areas of hills. They were all paddy fields where people once upon a time peacefully grew their rice and buried their dead. So, on the whole, yes.
You could move through quietly.
Well, as quietly as possible, yes. So